CET after that. All right.
Okay, yeah, firstly, let me thank Florian for asking me to give this review here. So in this talk, I would like to summarize some recent developments in the study of variation of discrete systems with the emphasis on the issue of broken symmetries and on a constraint analysis for variational discrete systems in the flavor of the Dirac procedure, which didn't exist before in full generality. This allows us to gain some new insights into the dynamics of such systems. So what I will be talking about is much more general than gravity, but I will illustrate some of the features here along the way by means of an edge calculus. So I will also try not to be too technical in this review talk and rather focus on the general ideas and general results. So I will begin briefly by specifying a bit more what kind of discretizations we're talking about. Then I will mention the issue of broken symmetries. Then I will outline the canonical formalism for discrete systems, in particular the constraint analysis. Then I will summarize its application to Radic calculus, which gives a completely general canonical formulation of it. And then if I have time, mention a few words on the quantization of such a formalism. So when we discretize continuum theories or at the level of the dynamics, we broadly have about two options. First of all, we could start by discretizing the continuum equations of motions or constraints. If we do this in gravity, I mean, this is what is done in numerical relativity, for instance. Turns out that when you do this, you generically get second-class constraints that are not preserved by the dynamics. So there are some issues in the discrete dynamics in this case. But we might as well, or another option is to instead discretize the continuum action. And then if the variables are continuous, if we have a variational action principle, we can obtain equations of motion simply by varying it with respect to the variables in it. And then these dynamics should be consistent because they just follow from an action principle. So the second option is also used, of course, as you all well know, in regularizations of the path integral in quantum mechanics, where we just chop up the time evolution in discrete steps. So yeah, in this talk here, we will follow the second option where we discretize a continuum action. Okay, so when you discretize a continuum action, there exists, of course, infinitely many ways of doing so. For gravity, this is, of course, the same. The most popular discretization is Radic calculus, or the most famous one, I should say. The general idea here is to replace a smooth d-dimensional space-time by some piecewise linear flat metric living on a triangulation which is comprised of d-dimensional simplices. And then when you have such a triangulation, the question is how can we describe its geometry? What kind of variables can we choose? Of course, there also exist many, many different possibilities. And in the Radic calculus, one basically takes the simplest choice of them, and that is based on the fact that once you know the length of all the edges in the triangulation, then you're in the position to compute whichever geometric quantity you want, such as angles, volumes, and so on. So they really encode the entire geometry of the triangulation, so its metric structure. And that is also the reason why in the Radic calculus, the length are the configuration variables. So the Radic action, in fact, depends on these length of all the edges in the triangulation. So when you now discretize the Einstein-Hilbert action, so here I give it with a bulk and a boundary term, it takes in the Radic formulation this form here, bulk and a boundary term. Let me just briefly explain how you can translate the curvature here into the discrete. So what we see here is we sum over all hinges in the triangulation. Hinges are d minus two-dimensional subsimplices. So in a four-dimensional context, these would be triangles. And these the bulk term sums over all triangles in the bulk. Here you have the volume of the hinge. So in four dimensions, then the area of the bulk triangles multiplied by so-called deficit angles. These deficit angles measure the deviation of 2 pi from the sum of all the dihedral angles around such a hinge in the bulk of the triangulation. So for instance, in two dimensions, if you take the vertex here and you add up all the dihedral angles in the triangles around this vertex and you find it deviates from 2 pi, then you have curvature. And so this also holds in higher dimensions. So the boundary term is very similarly constructed, just that we now have that we don't have deficit angles, but extrinsic curvature angles, which do not measure the deviation from 2 pi, but from pi of the sum of dihedral angles around hinges in the boundary of the triangulation. Okay, and it turns out that this Regge action is in fact additive in the sense that when you glue two pieces of triangulation together, then the total action contribution of this piece is just given by the sum of the individual action contributions. Okay. So now when we discretize theories in this way, it turns out that one generically breaks continuum symmetries. Let me just illustrate that briefly by the example of a particle, one-dimensional particle in mechanics and reparametrization invariance. So if you take the Lagrangian of the particle, where t is not a variable yet, you can extend the system, promote t to a variable, and introduce an artificial evolution parameter s. When you do it in this way, as it given here, it turns out that the dynamics is equivalent. But then on top of it, you actually have now that the system is invariant under reparametrizations of s. So this is kind of like the toy symmetry for the diffeomorphism symmetry of general relativity. So if we now want to discretize the system, what we would do is we would just choose a particular set of discrete values in this evolution parameter s, and then evaluate the variables x and t at these points and the values of the evolution parameter. And then we choose some suitable discretization of the action. There are many different choices. The details of that I don't want to discuss here, but the generic feature that happens is there's basically two general possibilities that arise. The first is if you do not have a potential, so a vanishing potential, then the solutions are, of course, just straight lines. And then because they're straight lines, it doesn't really matter where we position our vertices, so how we discretize exactly. Moving this vertex around just corresponds to a reparametrization in the parameter S. This still defines the same solution, of course, but obviously we can also just choose a finer discretization. That doesn't matter. That will still give us a straight line, the same solution. So at this case, when you have a vanishing potential, we actually have the continuum symmetry, the reparametrization symmetry preserved. However, the situation changes. When you have a non-vanishing potential, then the solution becomes a curve. And then, of course, if you discretize that, you approximate it. But if you now choose some kind of different parameters, different discretization, then quite obviously the curves will no longer agree. So the solutions are actually different, and which indicates that the symmetries are broken. So the situation for Regge calculus is no different. So I just note that here for the particle, I mean, these are just the solutions are just one-dimensional triangulations. Regge calculus describes higher-dimensional triangulations. And what happens here is that the analogous situation, that when you are in the flat sector of Regge calculus, you also have a vertex displacement symmetry. So this corresponds to vanishing potential. For instance, if we have the two-dimensional example here, and you imagine all these vertices to be embedded in the flat plane, and then you move around the central vertex such that it stays in the two-dimensional plane, of course, the geometry remains flat. Nothing has really changed, and this is a symmetry. However, when you now have a curvature present, then which corresponds to the case of a non-vanishing potential for the particle, then it turns out that the symmetries are broken. For instance, here you see a plot from a paper by Bianca Dittrich and Benjamin Barr. What you see here is the smallest eigenvalue of the Hessian of the Regge action for a particular Regge configuration. This is just the matrix of second derivatives of the action with respect to the bulk variables. If there are null modes, then that means there are flat directions at the extrema of the action, so there are actually symmetries. But and what you see here in this axis, this is a curvature perturbation, and what you basically see in this plot is that as the curvature grows, also the minimal eigenvalue grows such that we do not have zero modes anymore and the curvatures are actually broken. So the breaking of the symmetries are broken. So the breaking of symmetries actually has severe repercussions for the dynamics. So that means, for instance, that modes that are gauged in the continuum actually become propagating the discrete. So one example is a three-dimensional Regge calculus with a cosmological constant. Turns out that this leads to curved solutions. The symmetries are broken, and that means you have actually local propagating degrees of freedom in contrast to the continuum where you just have topological global degrees of freedom. But it is also important when you want to quantize the theory, because now you have actually modes that are propagating for certain configurations but are gauge for others. So when you want to define a path integral, you have to be careful with that. So, and in order to deal with this situation of broken symmetries, a machinery of coarse graining has been developed by, mainly by Bianca Dittrich and Benjamin Barr, and also Sebastian Steinhaus. But I do not want to talk about this research direction because Bianca will also talk about it later in the session. So, and instead here, I want to focus on a review of some canonical tools for extracting the dynamics of such variational discrete systems, which gives us a new perspective on their dynamics. Okay, so when before we can do this, first of all, I have to tell you a bit about discrete time evolution and discrete gravity. So in the continuum, of course, in canonical general relativity, the time evolution is generated by constraints, and you have hypersurfaces evolving through the full space-time solution. So here in the discrete, in the discrete, we cannot expect that constraints or a Hamiltonian generates the evolution because that would necessarily have an infinitesimal action, but time evolution is actually discrete. So we can already see that constraints actually have a very different role in the discrete than in the continuum. And this is what we want to understand. So instead, the time evolution in the discrete is generated by so-called time evolution moves. In the Legendre calculus, you can think of these simply as pieces of triangulation that you glue on some triangulated hypersurface. And then the more you glue on it, you evolve your hypersurface forward in time. So there exist many different choices. A particularly nice choice is to glue single symplices at each step of the evolution onto our hypersurfaces. So we count every step by some integer k. And for instance, if we have now a two-dimensional triangulated hypersurface that we want to build up into a three-dimensional solution, and we glue a single tetrahedra onto it, then within the hypersurface that will look like this here, these moves, these are time evolution moves, they're quite nice because these moves, they're actually called Pachner moves. They're ergodic moves, which means that given some initial data on such a triangulated hypersurface, you can generate an arbitrary other triangulation of the same topology via these moves. But one thing that we have to take into account now is that these moves are actually graph changing. So for instance, if you now consider the next move here, this will remove this vertex here and remove three of the edges adjacent to it. And now recall that in the Legendre calculus, the length of the edges are the configuration variables. And this tells us therefore that we have to deal with a time-varying number of degrees of freedom. With a time-varying discretization. So now I will outline how one can cope with this in a canonical language. So let's consider now some time evolution moves that we just labeled by k. So if we have now an evolution move from k minus 1 to k, so for instance, just some piece of triangulation that we glue onto a hypersurface, we associate a piece of action to it, label it by k, then we can just sum over all the time evolution moves, and then get the total contribution of the action. And now we can make use of the fact that the action contribution of each of these time evolution moves depends only on the old and new configuration variables. So in the Legendre calculus, the axis would simply be the length. Just note that I'm suppressing an additional index here for simplicity, but these axes are actually multiple variables. And then because they depend on the old and new configuration variables, we can use this action as a generating function of the first kind. And by differentiating it with respect to the old variables, we get the old momenta, which we call premomenta. If we differentiate it with respect to the new variables, we get the new momenta, which we call postmomenta. And we color them blue and red because we actually see that many of the canonical concepts turn out in pre and post form in the discrete. So I should say that actually these momenta are indeed momentum coordinates on a cotangent bundle. One can make this more precise, but I do not have time to discuss that here. Okay, so once you have these pre and post momenta in this form, note that they actually define an implicit canonical time evolution map, because given the canonical data at step k minus 1, we can insert it into this equation here and solve it for xk. Once we have xk, we can insert it into this equation and then compute pk. Also note that I'm not making any assumptions about the number of variables at the different time steps. They can vary in time. If they do vary in time, it turns out that this time evolution map is will not be bijection, but it will actually be singular, but that's something that we will discuss in the coming slides. Okay, so now we have only discussed a single time evolution move. If we now consider the next move from k to k plus 1, we can use the action sk plus 1 as a generating function. In this way, we'll also get a pre-momentum at step k, so we have now post and pre-momenta at step k. But it turns out when you now impose the equations of motion at step k, so these variables xk only appear in these two action contributions. And yeah, when you now compare this equation of motion here with this expression here and this one here, then you find that on solutions, the pre and post momenta have to coincide. And this is ultimately also the reason why the canonical and covariant formulation are equivalent. And you can do all of this for Rege calculus, but I want to spare you from the details. Okay, now let's start talking about constraints. In the continuum, the Legendre transformation is in coordinates simply given by that equation right there. The implicit function theorem will then tell us that if the matrix of second derivatives of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocities is degenerate, then not all the canonical data can be independent, and instead we will get relations between them, which we call primary constraints. In the discrete, the situation is analogous. So a time evolution move from k minus 1 to k is simply defined by these pre and post momenta that I showed you on the previous slide. And now because we have two momentum equations, we actually get also two types of constraints. And if this matrix here of second derivatives of this action contribution with respect to old and new variables is degenerate, then again, not all the canonical data at step k can be independent. We get relations between them. These we call post constraints, and likewise, not all the canonical data at step k minus 1 can be independent. We get relations between them, and we call those pre-constraints. Once you have these constraints, notice that the time evolution is not no longer unique, because if we have these pre-constraints, then not all of these equations here are independent. We don't have enough equations to solve for the xk, so we actually need to fix some a priori free parameters in order to determine what the xk are. Okay, let me just show you how this, just to give you a taste of it, how this arises in Rege calculus by a particular example. So I will consider the so-called 1-3 Pachner move in the three-dimensional theory, because this also is a move that deals with a varying number of degrees of freedom. So this move consists of the following. You have a two-dimensional triangulated hypersurface, and then you glue a single tetrahedron onto it in such a way that you get three new edges and a new vertex, but no edge becomes internal in the course of this move. That means that you don't get any new equations of motion. And because you don't have any new equations of motion, you don't have any way of determining what the length of these three new edges are. So they're actually a priori free. So this already indicates that we will face some constraints, and that is indeed the case. Let me tell you how that works. So firstly, notice that at step k plus 1, we now have three canonical pairs more than at step k, so we have a varying number of degrees of freedom. In order to deal with this, we can simply artificially extend the phase space at step k by adding three new canonical pairs in such a way that the action contribution of this tetrahedron does not trivially depends on these auxiliary variables. And if we now compute the pre-momenta, then, of course, of these auxiliary variables, the momenta have to vanish because the action doesn't contribute on the doesn't depend on the on these length variables, and so these are three pre-constraints. But we also get a set of post-constraints. So if you now compute the post-momenta, then it turns out that they're of these three new edges. Sorry, that it turns out that they are simply given by the extrinsic curvature angles around the three new edges. And these extrinsic curvature angles, they can be computed simply from the length variables that are already contained in that tetrahedron. So these are all variables from one and the same time step. That means that this equation here just relates the canonical data at one and the same time step. So these are also three post constraints. Okay, so it turns out that one can implement all Pachner moves in three and four dimensions in a completely analogous way. Also turns out that the transformations that they generate on the canonical data are so-called presymplectic transformations. Yeah?
May I ask a question? you take into account that these new lengths are not independent from each other?
Well, a priori, yeah, okay. I mean, this is something that you can take into account. Well, no, I mean, actually, a priori, they are independent. So, and then you can just a priori choose them. But if you do want to make it into a tetrahedron, that's true, then the third length is, of course, dependent on the choice of the other. That's true. Okay. So now let us consider the constraints a bit more so far. So let's discuss when they are actually generating symmetries. So far, we've only considered constraints that pre and post constraints that generate, that are generated by one evolution move from k minus 1 to k. But now let's consider what happens when you compose it with a second evolution move from k to k plus 1. So now the momentum matching tells us that that now the pre-constraints also have to be satisfied by the post-momenta, and the post-constraints also have to be satisfied by the pre-momenta. So you can think of these evolution moves here again. I mean, what I've drawn here schematically as pieces of triangulation. So and then it turns out that these pre and post constraints are in general at a given time step independent. So this is a non-trivial process. And there's all kinds of possibilities that can arise, which I do not have time to discuss here, but one can handle them. But instead, let me tell you what happens to the Poisson structure of these constraints. So it turns out that when you take the pre-constraints among themselves, they actually generate a first-class subalgebra, Poisson algebra, and likewise the post-constraints among themselves also generate a first-class subalgebra, but when you take the mixture of them, it turns out that generally, the mixture is second-class, which means that it also fixes some of the a priori free parameters that arise in the evolution. But one thing that you can also see here is that if you now have constraints that are both pre- and post-constraints, then by this result here, they will commute with all pre- and post-constraints, so they commute with all constraints, and they are therefore first-class. One can also show that they are, in fact, associated to gauge mode and that they do generate gauge symmetries, which actually also happens in the logic calculus. There are, however, some differences in the discrete here as compared to the constraint analysis in the continuum, because here in the discrete, it turns out, one can also have first-class constraints that do not generate any symmetries, but that simply just restrict the dynamics. Okay, how much time do we have left? Okay, all right. Okay, so now that we have talked about constraints, let me briefly discuss the notion of propagating data in the discrete. So recall that in the continuum, looking at the canonical data at one instant of time is sufficient to determine what are the propagating degrees of freedom, what are gauge modes. But here in the discrete, the situation is quite different. We actually need two time steps in order to talk about the notion of propagation, because the Hamiltonian time evolution map requires two time steps for its definition, and it maps from the pre-constraint surface at some initial step to the post-constraint surface at some final step. And it turns out that the propagating data, or the observables, in such an evolution move from some initial step to final step, commute with the pre-constraints at the initial step and the post-constraints at the final step. However, when you now have a time-varying discretization, it turns out that in general, the number of constraints at the initial step depends on the choice of your final step and vice versa, in such a way that when you actually have two different choices of initial and final step, and then, I should not have done that. Then the numbers of constraints at these different choices of initial and final step will, in general, disagree. And that also tells you that the numbers of propagating degrees of freedom between two different choices of time steps will, in general, be different. Okay, so this, for instance, one can illustrate by a discrete version of the no boundary scenario, where you start evolving from some empty triangulation to the hypersurface of a single tetrahedron or a four simplex, and then you continue evolving to some larger spherical triangulation. So clearly the number of variables here changes in time. It turns out that any evolution move from zero to any other time step k is always totally constrained. That simply means that there is no propagating data between nothing and k, which obviously makes sense because at zero there's nothing to propagate. But when you now take an evolution move from some finite intermediate step to a larger spherical triangulation, these moves will in general not be totally constrained, and there is actually propagating data on those other moves. Okay, one can now apply this canonical formalism that I've outlined to a Rajic calculus. You can implement whichever favorite time evolution move you have, so you can get a completely general canonical formulation of Rajic calculus. This is something new that wasn't possible before. So in this way, you can actually describe Rajic calculus as the theory of the dynamics or discrete dynamics of triangulated hypersurfaces in a triangulated space-time. So a complete analogy to the continuum general relativity. However, here are now some crucial differences between the three and four dimensional theory that I would like to summarize here. So in the three dimensional case, if you don't have a cosmological constant, the solutions are all flat. The symmetries, so this vertex displacement symmetry, is preserved. Turns out that each of the vertices is equipped with three constraints that are simultaneously pre and post constraints, as I mentioned them before on the previous slides. These constraints are preserved by the evolution, and they generate a vertex displacement symmetry. And because of this, it turns out that the three-dimensional case is hyperbolic in the sense that when you actually have an initial value problem, that different choices and different sequences of evolution moves will actually lead to equivalent solutions because they can be mapped into each other by symmetry transformations, if you like. In the four-dimensional case, the situation is very different because we now have curvature. This curvature breaks the symmetries, as I mentioned earlier. It turns out that the vertices in the four-dimensional theory are generally not equipped with constraints. So we actually do not have a hypersurface deformation algebra for a full Rajic calculus. So they don't generate any symmetries. They also do not generate the time evolution. And the four-dimensional case is non-hyperbolic in the sense that you can have for a given initial value problem, you can basically construct different solutions from it that cannot be mapped into each other by symmetry transformations because the symmetries are broken. Okay. However, in the four-dimensional theory, there still exists a sector, a non-trivial sector, that still preserves the symmetry of the flat sector, and that is a perturbation around it up to linear order. This at linear order, the perturbation theory still inherits the vertex displacement symmetry from the flat background, and it turns out that the vertices are each equipped now with four constraints that are simultaneously pre and post constraints. So we know they generate symmetries, and it turns out that they do exactly generate the vertex displacements. They are preserved by the dynamics, and they are first class. So it is also possible in this linearized case to easily disentangle the propagating from the non-propagating modes. So in a sense, what you can call lattice gravitons these are actually related to the linearized deficit angles. They form a complete set, and they are invariant under the action of the constraints. And using this formalism, one can describe the dynamics of the evolution. One can count them, and so on. So recall that now the full theory, in the full theory, the symmetries are broken. So we cannot expect that when we go to all orders in this perturbation theory, that the symmetries will survive. And it actually turns out that when you go to second order in the perturbation, you get non-trivial consistency conditions on the background gauge modes. These are kind of like their first equations of motions in terms of the orders of the expansion. So they become actually propagating. And it turns out that generally, one is led to perturbative inconsistencies, and it is not always possible to satisfy the consistency conditions at higher orders. Okay, how much time do I have left? Okay, so let me say a few words on how one can quantize such a formalism. So I will restrict to Euclidean configuration spaces where the n, the dimension, can vary from time step to time step, just to avoid some global non-trivialities in the canonical construction. In order to get physical states, one can simply use the group averaging technique, which I just one can formally write like this. So you basically use improper projectors acting on kinematical states, which will give you solutions to the physical states. And one can also construct a physical inner product by simply inserting the projectors into the kinematical inner product. So this is just the construction formally the construction of the physical Hilbert space. The question is now, how do the dynamics come into play? Because we do not have a Hamiltonian here in this formalism. We only have these discrete evolution moves. But in order to construct the dynamics, we can, again, as in the classical theory, make use of the action, and this time in the form of the propagator. So we can, given some time evolution move from some initial step 0 to 1, we can associate a propagator to it with some measure factor, which remains to be determined, and some action contribution S of this evolution move. Okay, and then using such a propagator, one can start constructing projectors from kinematical Hilbert spaces at neighboring time steps to the physical Hilbert spaces at, neighboring time steps, for instance, taking a kinematical state at time step 0, we can project it with the propagator and then integrate out the initial time step. Require that this gives us a physical state, or that it solves the pulse constraints, the quantum pulse constraints. Likewise, one can do the same with the physical pre-states by just taking the time reverse of the propagator. In order for this to work, these propagators must satisfy the constraints themselves, which is possible in our case because we still have this measure factor here, so we have enough freedom to actually allow for this. So in these propagators also have to satisfy a number of other conditions that we borrow from the continuum. And using this construction, one can then show that the discrete dynamics is in fact unitary in the sense that the physical inner product between different time steps is preserved. And this also holds for time-varying discretization. So if you now want to build a path integral from this, what we have to do is simply compose all these different propagators of the different moves. However, in particular, when we have a time-varying discretization, we have to take into account that we now get constraints in general. We have free parameters, so we actually need to regularize these different propagators, otherwise we get infinities. So one can use different methods, for instance, the Popov trick. There's many different cases that can occur, which I do not want to discuss here. But I just want to summarize it by reg that one has to regularize it. It can be done at least for certain cases. Okay, if you now have, let me just say a bit more about the time-varying number of degrees of freedom. So if the numbers of variables vary in time, then we can do the same trick as in the classical discrete theory. We can simply extend the configuration spaces in such a way that we have equal dimension at different time steps. If you do so, then it turns out again that the auxiliary variables are constrained in the sense that the auxiliary momenta have to vanish. We also have to impose that in the quantum theory. And this means nothing else than that the physical states do not depend on the auxiliary variables, which you, of course, would expect. So in a sense, the physical states are cylindrical functions on the extended configuration spaces. One can show that the physical inner product is invariant under these extensions in such a way that we have a notion of cylindrical consistency and can take the time-varying discretizations into account. And just as an example, if one can build a toy model with quadratic actions for the snow boundary proposal, where you evolve from zero to some finite set of variables, it turns out that for an evolution from nothing to something, you always get a unique physical state. Okay, let me just summarize. As I said, the symmetries are generically broken in the discrete. This has some consequences for the dynamics. So as I said, certain modes that are gauged in the continuum become propagating in the discrete. This has some non-trivialities for constructing quantum theory. We now have a general constraint analysis available for such variational discrete systems that can handle time-varying discretizations in a natural way. When you have a time-varying number of degrees of freedom, the constraints and propagating degrees of freedom become dependent on whichever evolution move you're considering. And this analysis can be applied to Rajic calculus in a way that you get a completely general canonical formulation of it. And you can, in this way, interpret the Rajic calculus as a theory of discrete dynamics of triangulated hypersurfaces in triangulated spacetimes. This gives a new perspective on its dynamics, and this is something that is also relevant for spinform models, where the Rajic calculus is supposed to show up in the semi-classical regime. And as I showed or mentioned in the last two slides, one can also quantize this formalism, at least for Euclidean configuration spaces. Thank you.
More a comment on the first statement of the summary, which is to say that it's true that in the classic discretizations you study, symmetries are broken.
Mm-hmm.
There are discretizations, and of course, a set discretization in some case where you don't violate Lorentz symmetry.
I know. So I mean,
just
no.
Because it sort of sometimes is misleading that discreteness
yeah.
always means.
No, that's completely correct. It actually, not only in causal sets, you even have that in lattice gauge theories, where you can also restore the Lorentzian symmetry by some coarse graining. And in fact, like this program that I just mentioned very briefly I just refer you to the talk by Bianca Dietrich this afternoon. The breaking of the symmetries is due to the particular discretization that you choose. So, for instance, I mentioned also that when you take a three-dimensional Rajic calculus with a cosmological constant, well, you get curved solutions that break the symmetries. But using a coarse graining method, you can actually construct a so-called perfect action for this discrete theory, which consists of basically choosing a refinement of your triangulation, integrating out intermediate degrees of freedom. What you get is an action, an effective action, which is better behaved as regards the symmetries. And in certain cases, such as in this three-dimensional case, you can actually take an infinite dimension or an infinite refinement limit. And then it turns out that in the infinite refinement limit, restore the continuum action, the continuum symmetries. So for instance, in this case, the infinite refinement limit is just basically kind of like spheres, and then on this you have a vertex displacement symmetry which corresponds to displacements along geodesics in this curved geometry. So that is correct. Then you have a discrete theory that actually has the continuum symmetries preserved. Yeah.
Any other questions? Spinning outside is seen as a kind of quantum version of twisted geometries, and so. Do you think that we could also apply this kind of stuff to this geometry? Because we expect that spin forms, like you said, spin forms give Rajic calculus, so somehow your quantum stuff should be related to.
Probably it is. I don't actually know too much about twisted geometry, so I don't want to say anything too speculative at this stage. But yeah, I would expect that many of these features should show up in spin form models as well. Also if you think about the spin networks in spinform evolution, you also have different graphs at different time steps, so which corresponds to a graph-changing evolution, as I discussed here also in the Rajic calculus. But yeah, I mean, the construction that we have here relies on the fact that we have an additive action, the Rajah action. So I'm not completely sure. I mean, if you use the Plebansky action, I think the discretization that is additive in this sense is at this stage not known. So that's why you cannot immediately take these results and apply them one-to-one to spin four models. But nevertheless, I would consider that for the at least the semi-classical limit, this is relevant.
Questions?
Is there a reason why you could only look at in the quantum, when you apply this, when you try to do this in the quantum theory, why you can only look at Euclidean?
No, I mean, the reason I only showed this in the Euclidean sector is because once you go to different, I mean, there's no reason why it should work for other configuration spaces. It's just that in order not to cloud the issues that you're trying to discuss, it's easier to just, for first start, look at it in Euclidean configuration spaces. I mean, you can also, for instance, when you go to the Rajah calculus, then you have to worry about the issue that, for instance, in three dimensions, the canonical momenta are angles, so they're compact. Then when you quantize this, then with the representation of the quantum operators, you have to be a bit careful with the self-adjointness and so on. So there's a lot of non-global, global non-trivialities that one has to take into account. And as a first step, I just wanted to circumvent those. But in principle, this should also work, of course, for other configuration spaces.
Any other questions? No, so let's thank everybody again.
Said, I'm going to talk about CDT, and in this case, transition amplitudes in CDT. So the first question you might ask is, what exactly is this? And you saw Renato Lowe's talk this morning, so hopefully you have some idea. But in broad terms, we'd like to use the tools from Lattice QFT, such as regularization, finite scaling, and renormalization to study a path integral. So we have a Lorentzian path integral that gives us a transition amplitude. And we'd like to wick rotate it into Euclidean signatures so that it becomes a partition function and we can study it. Unfortunately, for a general Lorentzian manifold, this isn't really well defined. So instead, we use what's called a causal triangulation, which I'll define in more detail in a moment, which defines a good wick rotation, which we can take to Euclidean signature, and where we can do we have a well-defined partition function. So a causal triangulation, I'll just talk about 2 plus 1 dimensions, but it's analogous in 3 plus 1, is a global foliation of space-time. Then you transform that into a piecewise flat manifold made out of simplices like these. So in these case, these are 3 simplices. And they always, looks like you can't really see the time slices. I apologize. The colors are bad, I guess. Each one spans between two space-like hypersurfaces, and they have space-like length a squared, or norm squared a squared. Time-like norm squared is minus a alpha a squared. So the wick rotation is to take alpha to minus alpha. And these are little pieces of Minkowski space that live in your larger manifold. And so all the curvature is contained on these edges here. In higher dimensions, it would be a surface instead of an edge. And these space-like triangles give you space-like area. And so when you put it all together, it looks something like this, or this is a piece of one. You can see each of these is 3 space-like hypersurfaces, and then the simplices connect between them. And furthermore, we also require that the topology does not change when you evolve this thing in time. So the space-like topology here has to be the same as the space-like topology here, which is obviously not true in these two cases. So this prevents wormholes and baby universes. So now that we have a causal triangulation, the way to study it is to do a numerical simulation where you Wick rotate, then you select a topology for your space-like hypersurfaces and a topology for time. And then finally, you fix the number of symplices and the number of discrete Euclidean time slices, which gives you this partition function, which is a sum over all triangulations with fixed time slices and symplices. And then it's the standard measure and e to the minus action. And then you do a Markov chain Monte Carlo simulation. So the natural question to ask is, what does the ground state look like? And one way to investigate this is to look at space-time topology, where you take each space-like hypersurface to be spheres, and then you, or topologically spheres, and you choose to make time periodic. And you can look for an observable, which is the volume as a function of time intuitively. And the way to actually measure that is to count the number of space-like triangles as a function of time. And if you choose a single time, this isn't a good observable, but if you look at the entire, if you look at it as a function of Euclidean time, it is. And here's a plot. And the first of exactly that, and the first thing you'll notice is there's these kind of flat lines here, which are actually minimal triangulations, which means they're, each one of these is a space-like tetrahedron. And you can think of this, this is an ensemble average, I should say that. We think of these as numerical artifacts and as physical, and I'll show you some evidence of why that is in a few minutes. And then the physical universe is embodied in this thing here, which is sort of, you can think of it as the bulk. And you can look at this and you can say that it looks very nice and very symmetric. And Muir and collaborators figured out that it follows this gravitational potential or effective action, which turns out to be the mini superspace action. And the an extremal for that action is Euclidean de Sitter space in this signature. And this fits very nicely to that. Euclidean de Sitter space is a sphere. So another question you'd like to ask is, what are the transition amplitudes of this model? And the sort of the canonical question you might ask in a path integral model is, if you have an initial geometry and a final geometry, what's the probability of transitioning from that initial geometry to that final geometry? And so you have some space-time with an action, has the standard Einstein-Hilbert, and then boundary terms, you then can compute a path integral over all space times that interpolate between the initial and final geometries. And when you do this in CDT, it's equivalent to simulating the partition function, which is a function of the triangulations for the initial and final geometries. And they're sort of a Hartle and Hawking have investigated this to some extent. So the standard, the wave function of the universe, and they said that the probability of any geometry emerging is a path integral where you take no initial geometry and then some final geometry. They looked at this in a Euclidean signature with the mini superspace truncation, and then to make it for ease of computation, and then they also used the saddle point approximation. And this particular action has several extrema. The first is just if you choose the final boundary to be also non-existent, so no boundary on either side, the extremum is a Euclidean de Sitter, it's a sphere. And if you want to look at their sort of the wave function where you have no initial boundary and some final boundary, then you get portions of Euclidean de Sitter where the pole is the no boundary, and then you have one of these circles as your final boundary. And Hartle and Hawking, when they did their contour integrals, found the sort of end cap of the sphere to be the extremum that they investigated. And finally, if you have sort of the thick sandwich problem, and you have an initial geometry and a final geometry as your boundaries, then you get sort of the intersection of the sphere. And we can investigate all these cases. So if you have minimum, if you have no boundary to no boundary, a no boundary in CDT is equivalent to a minimal triangulation, which is just a space-like tetrahedron. And so just to remind you, this is what this is the periodic case again. So this is the ground state. Looks like that. And you might notice that the actual number of time slices where you have, I called it bulk, or physical universe, is about 28 time slices. And you could ask what happens when you try and reduce the physical amount of Euclidean time and see if you still get something that makes sense, maybe get rid of those stalks. So this is a single space-time, whereas this is an ensemble, but you'll know it's not really peaked. And so it's very hard to get what looks like a coherent sum out of it. But now, so this is a plot of minimal boundary to minimal boundary, but this time with 64 time slices and fixed boundaries. And if you try the same trick and shrink the number of discrete time slices, you can actually get rid of these stalks and just get the bulk space-time. And so for this is sort of strong evidence that those stalks are actually numerical artifacts. And you can shrink the number of time slices even further, and something interesting happens, which is you still get a physical space-time, but it's the Wayne scale has been dynamically resized inside the simulation to get still a De Sitter universe. So you can also look at sort of the no boundary proposal, where you have a minimal boundary for your initial geometry and non-minimal for your final. And here's a number of different initial and final boundaries. So these are all ensemble averages, but I've suppressed the error bars for clarity. And you'll notice that they have these stalks at the beginning, and although they look like portions of Euclidean De Sitter, there's sort of a strange fit here. I'll talk about that in a minute. And you also notice that we get more than half of Euclidean De Sitter, whereas Hartle and Hawking got less than half. So let's zoom in on this orange plot here, which has a final geometry, which has 500 space-like triangles. And so this is that same plot, but all by itself. And if we try the same trick we tried before to get rid of the number of stalks, it actually does work by reducing the number of time slices. And so eventually, we can get rid of this sort of poor fit at the near the final geometry, and we can get rid of the stalk near the initial geometry. And this implies that maybe both of those are numerical artifacts. Perhaps, you might conjecture that this sort of poor fit here is the final stalk beginning to form. But that's just conjecture. And then you can also investigate the case where you have a finite initial and a finite final geometry as your boundaries. And you'll probably notice that these don't look like Euclidean De Sitter. They look more like hyperbolas or catenaries or something. And you can ask, well, how should we interpret this? And the answer may come from Hartle and Hawking's paper, where I lied to you before when I said the only extrema were sections of the sphere. What I failed to tell you is that those are if the scale factor for the mini superspace approximation is less than the length scale of the spacetime, so less than the De Sitter length. If you make it more, what this plot shows you, so this is not a plot of volume as a function of time, it is a plot of transition amplitude calculated by Hartle and Hawking as a function of the scale factor of the final boundary, if you do the initial boundary to be no boundary. And the red curve is showing what they found, and you'll notice that it sort of oscillates. And what's happening is that when you have the scale factor larger than the De Sitter length, the action becomes complex again. And so now you're no longer in a case where your partition function is over real Boltzmann factors. And so you'll also notice that it has an envelope that looks very much like these. And in this case, Hartle and Hawking implied that you would get sort of this sort of volume profile. So that may be what's going on. So that's what we've done so far. And there's some questions that these raise. So first, Hardow and Hawking got less than half the sphere in their no boundary calculations, for no boundary to finite funnel boundary, and we got the other answer. Other authors have gotten either answer, depending on the integral, the contour integral they chose. So you could ask, which of those choices do we make contact with? We could also ask, so Hardow and Hawking did some very good quantitative analysis on the scale factor larger than the De Sitter length, and it seems that we are in qualitative agreement, but we would like to know if we're in quantitative agreement. And I also showed you that when you shrink the number of space time, or the number of time slices in the minimal to minimal boundary case, the space-time length scale changes sort of dynamically. And so this makes you wonder, I'm going in the wrong order, I'm sorry. I'll do this one first then. This makes you wonder whether or not there's some length rescaling choice. So we made a choice about the direction of the time axis by choosing these causal triangulations, but it's not clear whether we made a choice about actual rescaling of the time axis. And the talk this morning would sort of imply that, it's maybe, just conjecture, maybe that implies that it's not, that there is freedom there, along with sort of the freedom that we found in the rescaling. And finally, it's important to note that the sitter effective action we found is highly symmetric, right? It's the effective action of the mini superspace, there's nothing but the scale factor in there as a degree of freedom. And this is dynamical, this showed up, this was not nonsatz in the theory. So it'd be interesting, now that we have the capability to choose fixed boundaries, if we can choose highly asymmetric initial or final boundaries to force the system out of this very symmetric state. Okay, thanks.
All right. Okay.
A question about this. I think it's very important, this idea to fix the boundaries, actually, and to look what happens inside, given that you have fixed certain boundary conditions. Can you do that also in the case where you have, let's say, a topology? I mean, you're in three dimensions, so a ball, and you take the two sphere as its boundary. So the boundary, I mean, from the Lorentzian point of view, has space like n time like.
So do you mean where the boundary is still space like and the radial direction is time, or?
No. I mean where the boundary has space like n time like.
I see. I don't know how to do that. It would be really interesting to try that.
Or you could, I mean, to make it simpler, maybe just look at a lens, for example, where you have space-like pieces which are touching each other.
Yeah.
Something like that. So that to get rid of the, I mean, I guess the problem with the amplitudes you're looking at is that, I mean, basically, you fix the number of time steps.
Yes,
right?
We do.
So that's, in some sense, that's already indirectly imposing boundary condition on the time-like boundary, right? But it would be better to impose it explicitly.
It's spatially closed.
Sorry?
It's spatially closed. It's two.
Yes.
Things,
yeah.
So
yeah.
There isn't a time.
Yeah, line. But. I think he does fix the number of time steps.
The number of discrete Euclidean time.
Yeah.
There are a set number of Euclidean time slices, so a number of hypersurfaces. Yeah, that's true. And there's so that question of rescaling and seeing whether it the Wayne scale of the space-time dynamically changes, so whether the De Sitter length changes is sort of, it's related to that question of whether or not we're fixing the time. I don't know. That would be really interesting to try.
But do you think you could do this kind of simulation with them? Or I don't
it,
know.
There would be
maybe it was the generalizations that are not.
There would be large algorithmic challenges, I think, because it's quite hard to actually design an algorithm to fix the initial and to insert a fixed initial or final geometry, because you have to make sure that doesn't violate the topology that you've chosen. And I only know how to do it for S2 cross I, but I think it'd be really interesting to try and figure that out.
Any other questions? No? So let's thank you.
I don't know if I'll use the hockey stick. I probably don't need this. I'm generally loud, but that's all right.
All right. So the next speaker is Aaron, and he also.
Well, dynamical triangulations, actually. So I'd like to talk about explaining dark energy from discrete spacetime. So just a bit about the observational evidence. So there's multiple independent lines of evidence that all point to about 70% of the matter energy in the universe being this mysterious dark energy stuff. And all of the data are consistent with dark energy as a cosmological constant, equivalently a uniform positive vacuum energy density of about lambdas 10 to the minus 122 in Planck units. So everything in this talk will be in Planck units. I should also mention that the data are also consistent with more exotic models, in particular ones where the cosmological constant varies with time. All right. So one of the main problems with lambda is, why is it so tiny? So naive quantum field theory says that lambda should be about 1. You can cook up supersymmetric field theory models where lambda is forced to be exactly 0. But it's very difficult to find a natural way to get this very tiny positive number out of a theory. So there are various explanations. The one I want to point you to mostly here is the holographic dark energy model. So here they postulate that the accelerating expansion is due to entropy on the cosmic horizon. But there are various other models here for dark energy. All right. So I'd like to present a new model for the origin of dark energy. And here's the basic story. So first of all, space-time is fundamentally some kind of discrete geometry. Hopefully I'm in the right place for you to believe this. And in a discrete geometry, I think it's sort of a general fact that there are more ways to encode states with total scalar curvature negative than positive. So this bias, you would expect to perturb the ground state, perturb the vacuum, and give it a small amount of negative scalar curvature. And this intrinsic negative scalar curvature to the vacuum is indistinguishable from the effect of a positive vacuum energy density. All right. So I believe the story is supported by the basic structure of the Einstein-Hilbert action. So let me say a little bit about that. Here it is. So I'd like to point out a couple features of this action. So first of all, only the scalar curvature term here has a physically distinguished zero value. In quantum field theory, on a fixed space-time background, you can add an arbitrary constant to the Lagrangian and nothing changes. So you might as well just set the cosmological constant to 0. So I think this makes it reasonable to suppose that the origin of a non-zero lambda in our universe comes from some quantum effect connected to the scalar curvature field. All right, so that's the first point. The second observation I want to make is that we would expect an entropic perturbation on the value of a global observable, like total scalar curvature, to be independent of the local dynamics of the theory. And lambda is the only term here in this action that fits the bill. It's the only term that's independent of the metric. So these two observations, I think, lend some credence to the story that I just told you. Okay, so sure, it's a nice story. Can we actually fill in some of the mathematical details? Well, if the answer was no, I'd be kind of wasting your time. But I'm actually able to compute this effect in a novel variant of dynamical triangulations. and the value that you get actually turns out pretty reasonable. So I think this is very exciting. Just a little bit of background about the model. So the states in the model will be regular old dynamical triangulation states, so triangulations of a compact N-manifold. And we'll use the standard vanilla DT action, so G is 1, lambda is 0. However, the theory is not dynamical triangulations. And the reason for that is we'll restrict the triangulations that enter into the partition function, just like is done in CDT, although here the restrictions will be based on the value of the action for the triangulation rather than any consideration of causality. Okay. So the thing that we'll be looking at, if you will, the observable, is the average DT action per spacetime volume for triangulations of a spacetime with a fixed volume, which we'll call V. So here's a nice formula for this mean dynamical triangulations action. We've got a term that depends only on the dimension, L to the minus 2, and then a term that has to do with the average hinge degree. In particular, a term that, that has to do with the difference between the average hinge degree and the value you would expect in flat space, just 2 pi divided by the dihedral angle. This is a nice formula. So typically, we will suppress the L and N dependence and write this just as a function of mu. And I like to interpret this quantity as mean scalar curvature over the triangulation. And you should note that for a fixed mean hinge degree that's different from this flat quantity, that this diverges like L to the minus 2. Okay, so this is our observable that we're going to use. Okay, so for, from now on, we're going to focus on dimension 3. And the result that I was able to prove that makes this model work is that for any closed 3-manifold and any number of tetrahedra N3, there's a huge range of mean action values where the attainable mean action values are regularly spaced. So here's the exact expressions. Let me just kind of digest this a little bit. So the mean actions are regularly spaced, and the spacing between these action levels is actually very simple. It's 1/8 L over V, a nice little formula. And this actually turns out to be the smallest possible separation between mean actions that are consistent with a fixed number of tetrahedra, N3. So that means that we've actually listed all of the attainable mean actions in this range. Okay? So this is actually nice because the range given in the theorem is huge. So it basically goes like plus or minus L to the minus 2. So already when L is the Planck length, L equals 1, these are enormous energy densities that are covered by this regularly spaced range. Okay. So what are we going to do with this theorem? Well, we're going to use it to construct something that I like to call the N-action model. So vacuums in general relativity have scalar curvature 0. So we're going to aim to build a model that includes triangulations so that the expected action is 0. We're not quite going to get there, but that's the goal. All right, so for each L and corresponding number of tetrahedra that we need to triangulate our spacetime, we're going to let A0 bar be the closest attainable action value to 0. So we're going to include triangulations in the model with that action value, along with triangulations that have action values given by the n possible actions on either side of this A0. Okay, so nice and symmetric. Okay, so by our main result, this theorem that I talked about, if the number of action values that we use in this model grows slower than L to the minus 2, then eventually for small enough edge length L, all of these actions will lie in this regularly spaced interval. And the partition function in the model will have this nice form. So notice this bit that has the regularly spaced actions, just A0 plus a constant times the separation, or k times the separation. Okay, that's great. But we don't expect all of these action values to be equally degenerate. So we also need an entropy term. So here I'm calling this sk. This is just the natural log of the number of triangulations with action ak. All right. I think it's called the measure term. All right. So that's constructing the model. And we, of course, have the standard expected action formula. Here it is. Unfortunately, it's currently impossible to write this expected action as a nice closed form expression because these entropies are too difficult to compute. All right, so we're kind of stuck. But I believe that there's an approximation that we can make to make progress here that's actually really reasonable. And I'll present some numeric evidence at the end that supports this. So we're going to make the affine entropy approximation. So we're going to assume that in this model, from one action value to the next, that the change in entropy is constant. So this constant may depend on the number of tetrahedra, but not on the action value. So if we do this, we can actually compute a nice closed form expression for the expected action. Here it is. So I want to point out some features of this. So notice the first three terms here. They all scale like the separation between actions. So as L goes to 0, they'll go to 0, as long as these denominators here don't go to 0. But notice the eta's in the denominator. So if the entropy change from one action to the next isn't 0 in the limit as the number of tetrahedra goes to infinity, then those terms won't cause a problem. They'll go to 0 as L goes to 0. Okay. The interesting term is the one at the end. So if we use an infinite number of actions, or a number of actions that grow, the last term will be dominant. And in fact, if the entropy change is not 0, the hyperbolic cotangent term will just be plus or minus 1, depending on whether the entropy change is positive or negative. So this will be sort of the key formula that we'll use. Okay. So now we need to confront the question of choosing an appropriate n. So ideally, we would have in hand some complete dynamical triangulation style theory of quantum gravity, coupled to matter, provably reducible to general relativity, all that good stuff. And it would tell us what an appropriate number of action levels to use in this sort of toy model. We could ask, you know, how far is a typical state in the partition function from zero action, and that would tell us n. But we're not there yet. Okay, but I do believe that we actually have enough machinery to make an intelligent guess as to what this theory would tell us about n. So how would that work? Well, let's make this affine entropy approximation, and let's further assume that this entropy change from action to action doesn't approach zero as the number of tetrahedra grows. All right, so first point is that we need to have a number of actions in the theory that goes to infinity as our edge length goes to zero. Otherwise, all the actions in the theory would approach zero, and we wouldn't really be justified in calling it a quantum theory, some sort of weird classical thing. The other point I want to make is that if you have a number of actions that go to infinity, we need n delta a to be bounded, nonetheless, because otherwise this nice observable we're thinking about, mean scalar curvature, wouldn't converge. So this basically fixes our choice for number of action levels. Since the separation between actions scales like L, and n needs to be a dimensionless number, we need to have something over L, and the only other parameter in the theory is volume. So we're essentially forced into the choice of using V to the 1/3 over L action levels. That's the only thing that gives us the properties that we want. Okay. So now let's get to the point here, the cosmological constant. So for this choice of n, and using the affine entropy approximation, and let's assume that this entropy change is less than zero, I'll talk about numerical evidence in a minute, then we can actually compute the limit as the edge length goes to zero of the expected mean action. I'm thinking of this as the expected mean scalar curvature. And we get something like negative volume to the negative 2/3. Okay. Which by our whole interpretation of this situation gives us an effective cosmological constant of something like volume to the negative 2/3. All right, so that's sort of the end of the mathematical portion here. The question now is, can we use this nice result to say anything about lambda in our universe? So this is sort of a speculative thing. We live in a four-dimensional universe, it's not closed. But I think if we consider the big missing portion of this causality, that tells us something about what we should plug in to get a reasonable estimate in our universe. We should plug in something like the Hubble volume. So this is roughly the volume of space that's had time to causally communicate with our neighborhood since the beginning of time. So if we do this, then our theory gives a time-varying cosmological constant proportional to the Hubble parameter squared. So this is actually nice. This resolves a lot of problems with the cosmological constant. And in fact, if you plug in the Hubble constant, then we get lambda is about 10 to the negative 123, which is pretty close. So this is very exciting. All right. So I want to talk about some of the common features that this model has with holographic dark energy approaches. So the most obvious one is that we get a cosmological constant that scales like the area of the cosmic horizon. Okay. Even though there was no holographic assumption put into the model, The scaling comes from the separation between mean action values and the requirement that things behave nicely in the L goes to zero limit. So that's nice, but there are actually deeper similarities between this model and holographic dark energy. In our model, we have two cutoffs, L and N, and we coordinate these cutoffs in a way so that the entropic perturbation away from scalar flatness is bounded as L goes to zero. In holographic dark energy models, there are also two cutoffs, a UV and an IR field cutoff. And they're removed in a coordinated fashion so that entropy is maximized in the Bekenstein bound. So there's actually some really kind of amazing similarities between these two approaches. All right, so that's kind of exciting. Last comment I want to make here is that for universes that are very small, on the order of Planck volume, we predict a cosmological constant on the order of one, and hence very rapid expansion in the early universe. So this actually raises a tantalizing possibility that perhaps cosmic inflation and dark energy in the current era are manifestations of a common effect. And this is actually something that people are actively investigating in the holographic dark energy community. Some papers. So I promised to talk a little bit about the numeric evidence. So what I did was sort of use a standard Metropolis Monte Carlo sampling algorithm to sample from triangulations of the three sphere near a target mean action zero and various target numbers of tetrahedra. So if you do this, then what you see is nice Gaussian distributions in the measured mean action. So the fact that this is a Gaussian distribution tells you that the dependence of entropy on action is linear. The fact that these distributions are, that the peaks are displaced to the left, tells you that the slope of this dependence of entropy on action is negative. So that fits with what we're assuming. But we also need to know that this eta value that looks like it's negative here doesn't approach zero as the number of tetrahedra grows. So what we do is we simply do the sampling procedure for larger and larger numbers of tetrahedra. And you can see that it starts out negative at the smallest values and just gets more negative. So even at large volumes, it looks like it removes like 5 bits of information each step. So how am I doing on time? Good? Should finish in. Okay, that's it. This next one's the last one. So you can also check this as get a sanity check by looking at censuses of 3-manifold triangulations at very small numbers of tetrahedra. It's like silly, like 9 tetrahedra, but you see exactly the same pattern. The vast majority of states are at negative action. So, and that's it. So I hope that you have questions. Thank you. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So if it follows that formula that it is the Hubble constant squared at the time of nuclear synthesis, then it totally ruins. I mean, the energy density in lambda, the omega lambda, will completely swamp the other sources. I mean, the relativistic matter, and it would make the expansion of the universe way too fast.
Too much inflation.
No, it's not inflation, it's nuclear synthesis. It's way after inflation.
Okay.
So all the estimates of the abundances of light nuclei would just be totally wrong. So I think it's just ruled out. It can't.
So that's interesting. They address this issue in some of the holographic dark energy, like the paper I said at the very end that tries to explain inflation with this. I'm not an expert on that stuff, but my understanding is that it's sensitive to exactly how you define the horizon distance that goes into the theory. So I just sort of waved my hands and said, Hubble volume. So I think there are more subtle ways of defining the horizon in the early universe that are different that avoid that problem. But you're absolutely right. I mean, that could very well falsify it. So that's certainly something to worry about.
Yeah, well, I'm still, we've not talked about this.
Yes.
Worried about your physical interpretation. And,
yes.
Given that the ensemble you're working with is a sub ensemble of a set of geometries that have to deserve the name, which we know to be extremely degenerate. So there's a crumple of geometries which have nothing to do with extended geometries,
so,
as you can tell.
Yeah, so let me just say that, you know, the crumpled geometry stuff, there's no restriction on total action, right? So I believe that the crumpled geometries that you're talking about would have very negative action. So, I mean, we are actively excluding geometries that are crumpled everywhere. They may be crumpled many places, and that may spoil it. So one thing I want to say is that I'm not claiming that this partition function, this restriction that I'm putting on it, that this is necessarily the end-all theory. There may need to be additional restrictions that we put on the set of triangulations, like causality, to get the proper behavior. But what I think you might expect is that this strong entropic bias towards negative curvature states remained. In fact, I think I've read things in the CDT literature that the phase where there's lots of little bubble universes, so I've heard that described as the remnant of the crumpled phase. So I think that's similar. I think entropy is pushing towards more negative scalar curvature, even though you have put strong restrictions with the, you know, foliation by spatial hypersurfaces. So I think, you know, we could add restrictions to perhaps fix your objection.
Well, I think you would have to in the first step, but
yes.
Then of course we get to the next part of our criticism, which is curvature is not at all what the naive curvature.
We'll have to talk about that more. I'm a mathematician, so you know, we have one nice measure of curvature here, angle defect, and we're adding it up for everywhere in the manifold. So it seems very intuitive to me that that's total scalar curvature. Also, I guess I thought that was sort of the central idea all the way back to the Regé calculus, that discretizing the Einstein-Hilbert action. You know, that this is the right way to do it.
Truth of finite geometry, but of course it's not true in any continuum limit at all.
Yeah. I'm actually not partial to the L goes to zero limit. I would prefer sticking with finite L, but that's my mathematical perspective.
From a mathematical perspective, you know, I have no argument, but then of course you are trying to interpret it. I mean, it's quite far reaching, you know, physical consequences. I mean, that's maybe a little rash.
Yes, I'm confused about something extremely
sure.
Basic here, although it may just be a difference in conventions.
Sure.
In the usual convention, we now have a positive cosmological constant, and the positive cosmological constant corresponds to a de Sitter universe with positive curvature. So I don't understand why negative scalar curvature corresponds to positive cosmological constant.
So that's a good question. So my understanding, you know, I'm actually not I'm not an expert on general relativity. I'm a mathematician. I think of myself as a discrete differential geometer. But you know, is it not true that the scalar curvature is the trace of the matter energy tensor, right? And for
with a sign. So there's a convention here, and it may be that you're using a different sign.
Yeah, that's very possible that it's a sign convention. I mean, my intuition is that it has to be something like negative curvature. I mean, the spatial separation between freely falling object is increasing. So that's, from my mathematician point of view, that's negative curvature. You know, geodesics diverging. But this may just be a sign convention. I mean, one thing is that if you are bothered by interpreting it as total scalar curvature, if you want, you can just think of it as action. So if we, you know, if we look at, let's go back to the Einstein-Hilbert action. So if we go back to the Einstein-Hilbert action, what we did was build a model where we had every expectation that our action was zero. And we got a non-zero action for entropic reasons, totally unconnected to the local dynamics. And if we get a negative term on the left-hand side, I think the only reasonable thing to blame it on is the cosmological constant and a positive lambda fits. That's what makes the action negative. So the anomalous negative action I'm blaming on the cosmological constant.
But you want your cosmological constant to then feed back into the curvature, right? And if you work out r minus 2 lambda in a solution of the Einstein field equations, you'll find that r minus 2 lambda is equal to plus some constant times lambda. because R is proportional to lambda as well.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, I'm not sure what to how to answer that. But you know, one thing, if you want, we could back up and just say that then this theory explains the magnitude and not the sign. I mean, my mathematical intuition is that if geodesics are diverging, that has to be some kind of negative curvature. That's, you know, converging geodesics, that's positive curvature. But maybe it's a sign convention. I don't.
Yeah, no, they diverge in anti-de-Sitter sets as well.
This is the solution with positive cosmological constant, but you assume the spatial slices are flat, right? Am I not? Or I'm thinking Friedman-Walker. Sorry. Yes. Yeah. Anyway, are we done? Yes. Thank you. Well, we should talk about it more.
Yes. Okay, so I'm sorry to everybody who wanted to hear about causal sets and locality. You're welcome to talk to me about that in the coffee break or at any other point when I'm not busy listening to people or talking to myself. So today I'm going to talk about work that I've done with Yanambion, Yuki Sato, and Yoshiyuki Watabiki, and it's about a CDT Hamiltonian from Hrabal-Lifshitz gravity. So the claim has been made that CDT and Hrabal-Lifshitz gravity should be the same, that Hrabal-Lifshitz should be the continuum theory associated to CDT, since both have a preferred time foliation. And we decided to investigate that. So the plan of my talk is that at first I'll tell you why people thought that they could be connected. After that, I'll explain to you what we have actually done. And in the end, I'll try to put that into context and do my best to answer the question, are they the same or not? Of course, it's a hard question to answer. So why should they be connected? First, this is my introduction slide to explain to you CDT and Hrabal-Lifshitz. So I hope all of you have some pre-exposure. About CDT, there's to know that it's a path integral formulation, it's non-perturbative, and it is not fundamentally discrete. We hope to take a continuum limit. For that, we need a phase transition, but that's okay. And it's an Euclideanized theory. Euclideanized, but we have the time foliation, and the time foliation does allow us to take a big rotation afterwards. Hrabal-Lifshitz gravity is a power counting renormalizable proposition for a UV complete theory of gravity. It has a preferred time foliation and it's a continuum theory. And it has the anisotropic scaling, which is one of the points that people thought why Hrabal-Lifshitz and CDT could be similar. Both have time that scales different than space. In CDT, it's a matter of convenience for the Wick rotation. We need the additional parameter. In Hrabal-Lifshitz, it is the fundament of the theory that time scales different than space, and that leads to renormalizability. So why did we think that they might be connected? Well, both theories have an interesting phase structure. Both have a triple point, and it has been examined how the phases look in CDT, we have the large extended phase, we have the crumpled phase, and here we have a fluctuating phase. And in Hrabal-Lifshitz, there's also three different phases, and they are similar to those in CDT. The other thing is the spectral dimension has been found. The spectral dimension in CDT starts out somewhat below what it should be, and it goes from 2 to 4, roughly. In Hrabal-Lifshitz, a similar behavior has been analytically calculated. Also, there are simulations of Hrabal-Lifshitz theory that are using large parts of the CDT machinery. And of course, both theories have the same symmetry group. That is a very strong argument. The same symmetry group in physics means there is a connection. We know a lot of things that have the same symmetry group and can therefore be dual in some sense. Here's a little disclaimer. The work that I've been doing is in two dimensions. That is mainly because two dimensions are easy. We can use two dimensions. We can calculate it analytically in CDT and also in Hojava-Lipschitz. Two dimensions we can handle. If we try going to four dimensions, yeah, everything is a mess. So a very short slide. I said that we derived a CDT Hamiltonian from Hojava-Lipschitz gravity. So first I'll explain to you what is the CDT Hamiltonian. It's a very short explanation, but basically in two-dimensional CDT, we can calculate the two-loop function. We can calculate the transition amplitude from one loop L1 to a second loop L2. To calculate this transition function, we can sum over all possible geometries between them. There's something called the transfer matrix approach, where we basically can build up all these possible transitions by just summing over the different slices and all possibilities for them. So we sum over all geometries and with this action. And in two dimensions, we can do that analytically as a generating function. And if we do that analytically, if we have the loop-loop correlator, that correlator you can also write as an expectation value, and then you can do a expansion in t, say for a small time, and then for a small time you'll get out the Hamiltonian. Okay, I should have maybe put a bit more on the slides, but I was afraid that I wouldn't hold my time. So anyways, we can derive that this is a Hamiltonian. And now it would be nice to see that we can connect this Hamiltonian to Hojava-Lipschitz, so let's change over to Hojava-Lipschitz gravity. In Hojava-Lipschitz gravity, the metric is written in the ADM formulation. This is our metric. We have the Laplace function, the shift function, and here is the spatial metric, which of course is a scalar in two dimensions since we only have one spatial dimension. The interesting point in Hojava-Lipschitz, I'm talking about projectable Hojava-Lipschitz, that means that our Laplace function is independent of time. There's also non-projectable Hojava-Lipschitz, but it is not widely agreed on if that theory is pathological or not. But it turns out that CDT and that for our purposes, the projectable Hojava-Lipschitz case is good enough. If we have the metric, then we can write down an action. And the action for Hojava-Lipschitz gravity in two dimensions is this. This is the scalar external curvature written out here. It's a standard definition. And if we know the external curvature, we can calculate the momenta. The thing is, only the metric has a momentum. The momentum for both the Laplace and the shift function are zero and thus become constraints.
The little lambda there, is that the one that goes into the supermetric? Is that the little lambda that goes into the supermetric?
Yeah, the new parameter you get in Hojava-Lipschitz. In general relativity, the little lambda would be 1, and therefore our action would only have the large lambda and would become rather boring, and we couldn't do much with Hamiltonian formalism. So if we have this, we can actually use the Hamiltonian formalism and get something halfway interesting. So if we do the Hamiltonian formalism, we have Laplace function times Hamiltonian constraint and shift vector times momentum constraint. Our Hamiltonian constraint and our momentum constraint are here. And now you see that the momentum constraint is actually fairly easy to solve. If we try solving the momentum constraint, we see immediately the only way to solve that is if our momentum is only time dependent. So we can say that the momentum has to be time dependent. But if we have the momentum being only time dependent, our Laplace function is also only time dependent because we are in projectable Hojava-Lipschitz gravity, That means that we can actually introduce the loop length. We define the loop length as the integral over gamma. In the metric, we had gamma squared, and now we have only gamma, so that was for convenience. And then our Hamiltonian is only dependent on time. We do not have any integral anymore. And at the same time, we have the momentum constraint immediately satisfied. If we want the Hamiltonian constraint to be satisfied for all times, then we have, that is a constraint on the values of little lambda and big lambda that are allowed. So we do not, the momentum has actually to be a constant. If we want to change that, we can do take the a lesson from Liouville gravity and make the cosmological constant dynamic a Lagrange multiplier and fix the volume of the universe. So we find this Hamiltonian, which is only time dependent. And now we can try quantizing that Hamiltonian. We rescale to get rid of the factor in little lambda. As long as it is not one, that is possible. And after having rescaled, we can then gauge fix the lapse function. Since the lapse function is only multiplying the overall factor, that is not a problem. We gauge fix it to one, and then we can introduce canonical commutation relations. We have the Poisson bracket between L and its momentum, and transform that into a commutator. There's our Hamiltonian. There's a little problem with that, because canonical quantization like this, well, what is with the ordering ambiguity? We don't know which order of the momentum operator and the length operator is the right one. So there are three possible orders for that. This one, this one, this one. And these three operators, these three orderings in the position basis actually all have an interpretation in a CDT context. The first ordering, that is what we'd find in CDT if we have an open boundary and do not mark a point. So, like here, open boundary, no marked points. The second ordering, that is if we have a closed boundary and mark one point on the boundary that then. And the last one is a closed boundary and not having marked a point. So all three possible orderings actually have an interpretation. For the CDT Hamiltonian that I derived before, I should have maybe mentioned that it is for open boundary conditions and without a marked point. So CDT and Hojava Lifshitz in two dimensions do share the same Hamiltonian. But are they the same because of that? Well, so the Hamiltonian in two dimensions also agrees with the mini superspace formulation of general relativity. This is not surprising. We only have one degree of freedom, really. So we should expect to find that. But because the symmetries are the same, and we expect that in two dimensions, Hojava-Lifshitz is the continuum theory of CDT. In four dimensions, the story is somewhat more involved. So the difference between Hojava-Lifshitz and CDT is also in the action. In CDT, the action is only the Einstein-Hilbert action. In Hojava-Lifshitz theory, in higher dimensions, you also have to add all possible higher curvature terms. In two dimensions, those higher curvature terms just don't exist. That's why I didn't mention them before. In higher dimensions, these curvature terms do appear. So, but CDT, we have one thing that we have not, that I have more to mention, because the struggle between entropy and action. The entropy in CDT can actually be understood as higher curvature terms being added. So these higher curvature terms could come from the entropy, and then Hojava-Lifshitz and CDT would be the same. So the answer is, yes, CDT is Hojava-Lifshitz gravity at some points in phase space. There might still be other points in phase space that are isotropic, that could be isotropic and be general relativity. In fact, I can show you. This is our phase diagram of CDT. This is the triple point, and at the triple point, the anisotropy is very high. So here we would expect to find Hojava-Lifshitz gravity as a continuum limit. However, there's another point where the phase transition disappears, and that special point might be the point where general relativity is a continuum limit. So to conclude my talk, CDT and Hojava-Lifshitz have the same symmetries, and in two dimensions, we know that they have the same Hamiltonian. So Hojava-Lifshitz is the continuum theory for at least part of the CDT phase space. Thank you for your attention.
Say anything about the case where a little lambda is equal to 1?
We have not specifically looked at that point because that's there's no action to work with. I wouldn't know what to do. Okay. I mean, with our rescaling and so that point gets very singular.
So I'm probably just misremembering something here, but in two dimensions, don't the Gauss equations tell you that k squared is essentially just the two-dimensional scale of curvature? So I'm confused about this action. In 2D, it's the 2D scale of curvature should be the 1D scale of curvature, which is 0 plus something quadratic in the extrinsic curvature, and the extrinsic curvature only has the one piece. So it's not entirely clear to me that this is a different action, but I may just be being stupid about this. The question is whether lambda just amounts to rescaling, whether you can absorb lambda by just rescaling the metric or the cosmological constant.
I don't know what to say about that right now.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, could you explain what you mean by the CBT and
In both you have the foliation and you have the spatial foliation, which is fully diffeomorphism invariant, and in both you have the foliation. That was why I understood that as meaning the same symmetry group.
I would just disagree because we don't have any coordinates, so the diffeomorphic group doesn't act there. It seems to me you're overstating the case a little bit. And of course, as I showed this morning, this distinguished correlation can probably be done away with. So I think your conclusion that CBT equals Hojava-Lifshitz gravity beyond two dimensions is a lot more than very speculative. You know very little about this.
Any other questions? Let's thank her and